Hello, I'm Jim Hausman, here to introduce the second of two spine sessions that we have. This spine session covers some more complicated issues: degenerative disease of the cervical and lumbar spine, introduction of new technology to solve some of those problems, such as arthroplasty, answering the question, should we fuse, decompress, or do an arthroplasty? Let me introduce the faculty to you. Vince Trinellis, who's professor of neurosurgery at Rush University Medical School in Chicago, is the moderator. He's assisted by Nancy Epstein, who's the chief of the neurosurgery spine and education section at Winthrop University Hospital in New York. And along with them are five other experts from North and South America who've had a lot of experience in this area. Falvinga Ostrubal, who's professor of neurosurgery, dean of the medical school at the Universidade de Caxias do Sul in Caxias do Sul, Brazil. Harold Deutsch, who's an associate professor and co-director of the Rush Spine Center, Rush University Medical Center, Chicago. Richard Hines, president of the BACK, B-A-C-K Center, where he's an orthopedic surgeon and is in Melbourne, Florida. Todd Landman, neurosurgeon, private practice in Landman Spinal Neurosurgery, also on the staff of Cedars-Sinai UCLA, St. John's Medical Center in Los Angeles, and Rick Sasso, who's an orthopedic surgeon, the head of spine surgery, and founder of Indiana Spine Group from Indiana University in Indianapolis. These people have had extensive experience with these kinds of problems, and we'll see what they have to say in regard to how you treat degenerative cervical spine disease. They're going to first start with the cervical spine. And you'll see the major discussion issues are going to surround arthroplasty. What are the criteria for doing an arthroplasty? Usually should be done on young people who have degenerative disease, normal alignment. You'll find some other criteria they introduce. There's a question about whether or not arthroplasties really work or not. And apparently, they'll tell you the 10-year data shows that it's more than two times better than fusion, and there's less adjacent segment disease. There's a problem with cost in different parts of the country and in South America. There's a different demands of the community. But the key part of the arthroplasty is that it preserves motion. So you'll hear the discussion about that among all these people. It's very productive. The next area is the lumbar spine. It's harder to do. You'll hear what the indications are. They're much, much narrower and hard to come to. There are complications if you want to go anteriorly, and it looked like the consensus there was to have an excellent vascular surgeon with you. You need experience in this area to do this. The questions then came up about what about revisions in the cervical spine? Do you replace an arthroplasty with a fusion? The orthopedic surgeons, if they put in arthroplasties, replace them with different arthroplasties. So you'll see what their discussion is about that. Should you do in the cervical region an anterior approach, a posterior approach? Should you do a fusion? Should you do a laminoforaminotomy? Or should you just do an arthroplasty right away? You'll hear what they have to say about it. I think it'll help you decide what you want to do in your part of the country and world. Question is, what's the standard of care? There is no standard of care. You'll see from these people that they're all experienced. They have different approaches to the problem. They've done a lot of cases, and you can't distinguish one from the other. It's based on their experience. And it also depends on each individual case. So we hope you learn a lot from this. It's an excellent session, lots of good discussion, should answer many of the questions you have. We appreciate your being here.
My name is Vince Trainellis. I'm moderating this session once we go. On our panel, looking at my screen, we have Rick Hines from Florida, Todd Lanham, who is in LA, Harel Deutsch, also at Rush here in Chicago, Astrubo Calavinha from Brazil, and Giuseppe Barbagallo was to join us, but he has a family issue that came up yesterday and will not be able to join from Europe, and I'm waiting for Rick Sasso to sign on. This is a session specifically focused on options in degenerative cervical and lumbar spine disease and with an eye toward the newer technology that is arthroplasty. And we have some cases that we hopefully can discuss, and they'll show whether we can discuss. Should we fuse? Should we just decompress? How should we decompress? And how do we reconstruct with after the decompression is done? And these cases should be somewhat in an area of equipoise in terms of procedure chosen, and hopefully the panel and the audience in their participation can all share their thoughts and ideas and how they would approach these cases. I'm gonna primarily present the cervical cases. Todd, who has a tremendous experience in lumbar surgery of this nature, is going to show us a couple of cases, and we'll discuss those. And once we get started, feel free to send in questions, or if something seems confusing, let us know. And also, if you have a particular idea of how you would handle the problem that we're not addressing, then put your hand up and share that with us. I think that at this point, there are many options for decompressing the cervical spine, and in the properly selected patient, the newer technology, arthroplasty, appears to have a number of benefits, but the key modifier is the properly selected patient. And I'll offer any of the other panel while we're waiting for these cases to, welcome Rick, I see you're in. If anyone has any other comments while we're waiting to see the cases, please feel free to speak up.
Vince, why don't you just take some of the time to, how do you choose and in what age groups do you choose to consider arthroplasty versus anterior discectomy and fusion, just as a general topic?
I think that if we consider the IDE studies, they had rigid criteria, virgin disease, one or two level, depending on the study. And if one adheres to those criteria, then, which would also include stability, normal line, relatively normal alignment, good bone quality, and so on. If one adheres to those criteria, you could expect to replicate the results of the studies, which were excellent. As any device gets out, people begin to expand the boundaries and start to treat patients that would not have been in the study primarily. And there are those that have shown good results in doing so, and some that have not shown such good results. And I think that's where the issue lies now. If we completely follow the rules, I think that we would get good results. But as we expand them and look to treat more degenerated segments, less mobile segments, how does that play out? Is it beneficial for the patient or not?
Yeah, I mean, some studies have shown that there's almost a twofold greater reoperation rate for the arthroplasties. And can you comment on that, as well as the difficulty in revising a previous arthroplasty?
I think the 7-year data would refute that. The 2-year data, the early data, there is a lot of noise. There's a lot of similarity to ACDF. There are no statistically significant differences, but around 5 years, as patients are followed, those two groups begin to diverge, and it's even more so at 7 years, and the need for further surgery overall and in adjacent segments is significantly less in the arthroplasty patients.
That's correct, Vince. The 10-year follow-up on The PROTUS, the Prestige LP, the MOBI-C all show statistical superiority and at least a twofold decrease in the incidence and need for adjacent segment surgeries. So probably 2.5 times less the chance for those need of operations at adjacent levels. And index level surgeries are also significantly lower with the arthroplasty over fusion. So I think that poses a great point is, you know, when we're confined to the restrictions of placing patients within trials that are purely adherent to the IDE inclusion criteria, it becomes very limiting. In fact, if we limited fusion to the true FDA criteria, it would be a much greater level of spondylolisthesis. We would not be fusing for just degens in general. So we do expand indications, whether we're completely aware of it or not. But certainly the use will increase because the data is so compelling and overwhelming that arthroplasty has statistical superiority, not non-inferiority, but statistical superiority in pretty much every outcome measure, neurologic outcome, overall success, neck pain scores, arm pain scores, and so forth. So, and revision surgeries are less indeed at the 7 and 10 year marks. So I think that, we'll see more arthroplasties, and as you know, I'm a big arthroplasty advocate anyway, so maybe I'm a bit biased, but I think the data is the data.
What about spontaneous fusion that's occurring at the level of the arthroplasty, and how does that impact your subsequent decision-making?
That is an entity, just as we can't get all fusions to fuse, all arthroplasties don't. The outcomes are similar to that of a fusion, which is still a good operation. Let me ask Struble, what is happening in Brazil in terms of arthroplasty, cervical, and then we eventually get to lumbar.
Thank you, Tornelis. In Brazil, we face the same idea. We try to rule out facet disease and osteoporosis in those patients, and try to select properly the patients for the surgical options. One thing that maybe is different from US, in Brazil, the device costs around 2.5 times more than the fusion. So we struggle to get insurance approval for this type of device. So I want to hear for you about, is the cost similar than one level fusion if you compare at the point of surgery?
Rick Hines, do you have any thoughts on that question?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because in a community practice like mine in God's waiting room in Melbourne, Florida, I mean, the arthroplasty is not taking off yet. That's the primary reason, the cost. I think the literature is clear, and I know many of you have contributed widely to it and have shown great results. But I will tell you what I see in the community is a lot of failures of arthroplasty in the cervical spine, and it's not because of the device, and it's not because of the theory, it's because of the lack of training. The average community surgeon isn't trained well unless they came up through the ranks of appropriate program, and what happens is they think they can just put them in. They don't understand center of rotation, they don't understand balance, they don't understand what levels are correct, they don't think about osteoporosis, they don't think about all the contributing factors that may cause failure. And I think this is what happens when we have literature done by the best technicians, the best surgeons literally in the world, who can probably make any operation work well. But the problem is when it translates to a community, will it do the same thing? And I think that's only a question of training. And the second point that was just made from Brazil, the cost has to be comparable. And I think it's going to get there. I think the training is going to get there. I think the cost is going to get there. And that's a wonderful option to fusion.
And Vince, if I, you know, the actual implant itself is certainly more expensive than the actual implant, but not the total number of implants for fusion. If you're plating with screws, you have the implant, then you have the graft or DBM, or you use iFactor or whatever graft you're using by the time you total that up. But the overall payment in California, now this certainly for those of you not in the United States, the payments differ state by state. But the reimbursements in California, the overall payout for an arthroplasty is significantly lower than it is for fusion. So we don't see the reimbursement to the facility nor to the surgeons, and certainly for arthroplasty, than we do for fusion.
Well, in Chicago, the implant cost for arthroplasty and fusion is the same. The surgeon reimbursement is less for an arthroplasty, so there is an incentive for surgeons not to do arthroplasties, if you will. And I think that you see that in what surgeons choose to do. I think if you look at most community surgeons, they would prefer to do a fusion. They're more familiar with it, and they're going to be reimbursed at a higher rate.
I believe what Richard said as well is highly, you know, very critically important, that the surgeons are, you know, doing an arthroplasty is not the same as doing a fusion. And as far as the decompression and the prep of the disc space itself and opening the foramen, because when you create an arthroplasty or place an arthroplasty device, you're maintaining motion. And so if, as we expand indications for a little more degeneration, there can be some degenerative uncinate spurring, things like that we don't tend to clear as widely for fusion, because you're immobilizing the segment, so it's not really necessary. But with arthroplasty, because you're going to create more motion, you will impinge in those foramen. And so some people still have radicular pains and symptoms, and placing the device, as also Richard said, is that placing that center rotation in the proper position, choosing bone quality, all those things are a tremendous factor, which are less so in that of a fusion. So there does need to be more education and training done for surgeons who want arthroplasty. Certainly here on the West Coast of California, we're seeing such a tremendous demand for motion preservation surgery. It's people come in and they will not have a fusion anymore. Or if they do have to have a fusion, they really have it explained well. So that's my thought on that.
Rick Sasso, what are your thoughts on lumbar arthroplasty?
All right, Vince. So we're changing the subject here a bit. So
while we're waiting for cases, I think we were as opposed about to both while we're waiting for cases, what do you think about lumbar arthroplasty?
All right. Well,
is there a role in what
I think
patients?
It's tougher. I think it's tougher, Vince. And I think the main reason is the diagnosis is much easier for cervical arthroplasty than lumbar arthroplasty. The indication for cervical arthroplasty is radiculopathy, and the outcomes are much, much better. That is not the case for lumbar arthroplasty. It's for degenerative disc disease, back pain. And boy, that's just tough. That's really, really hard. I think, though, that if you look at the FDA IDE trials that have been done, the outcomes of lumbar arthroplasty are actually really good. They're very, very good. But it does not have the same traction, at least in the U.S., that cervical arthroplasty has.
The outcomes are actually quite good as well. Mm-hmm.
Haven't there also been some major complications with removal of extruded devices in the lumbar spine, including some life-threatening problems?
Absolutely. That I think that's another issue that a revision anterior cervical operation is, especially in someone who does cervical spine surgery routinely, is not a big deal. On the other hand, a revision anterior retroperitoneal or transperitoneal approach is super hard. And you're right, Nancy, it is potentially life-threatening.
Is it super hard or is it really impossible at L5-S1 after you've gone through that area, at least in my experience with OLIF? It's just treacherous to go back near the iliac vessels, and the arthroplasty implants are very large. I just, in my experience, it's just a bad idea to go back and try to salvage one. And I agree, in the neck, it's not that hard to take out a failed arthroplasty or a pseudoarthrosis and repair it. but it's treacherous at L5-S1 and probably maybe so at L4-5. So I've had bad luck in trying to solve that problem where I can't get the arthroplasty device out. I fuse from the back and I get marginal improvement and I'm stuck. I don't know what else to do for the patient, but I'm not going to go back anteriorly at 5-1.
Yeah, I
think at 5-1, actually, it's not bad. You need to do a transperitoneal approach, though. You need to change everything. You need to do it transperitoneal, and your vascular guys have to be on it. We put wires through both femoral vessels into the iliacs to blow balloons in case we need to stop venous bleeding. And it's a big deal. I will tell you, though, the revisions I've done have all worked out really well. I've only done a handful, but the preparation is immense. And you tell the patient that it is potentially life-threatening.
And we've done a lot of L5-S1 revision and explants, whether they're for CAC knees or failed osseointegration, and anterior expulsed implants. And Nancy, the initial series of data when we were doing the Charte work, that was a bad implant, and the failures were mostly L5-S1 and the cores expulsed, and they also had kick-4 and locks. That's now changed with the ProDisc, and Active L is better. But L5-S1 is under the bifurcation of the vessels, and I think the key thing is people who want to really be lumbar arthroplasty surgeons, the key is getting a fabulous vascular surgeon, because all of our we abandon the transperitoneals and we do all retroperitoneal. So when we do an anterior retroperitoneal approach back at L5-S1, we just go on the contralateral side. So on an initial L5-S1, we always go on the right, because L4-5, that's where the bifurcation of the common iliac vessels is located, and that one always needs to be approached from the left retroperitoneal side to move the vessels to the right. So on a revision L5-S1, we'll go then on the left and have less scarring and then able to stay under the bifurcation of the common iliacs. And yeah, we do ureteral stents just so we can know where the ureters are located. We've not placed a vascular balloons for possible occlusion at L5-S1. At L4-5 we have. L4-5 is extremely difficult to mobilize the bifurcation, so I tend to revise those almost at an OLIF or a direct lateral. It's hard to get ProDisc out with the keels from that side. You do a partial corpectomy there. And also, as Richard said, it's hard to get a good fusion when you have an arthroplasty device in the front. It can take several times to get that to fuse. That micro motion over that implant just does not want it to allow the bone to heal properly in our experience.
I mean, given the complications that are quite severe with the arthroplasties in the lumbar spine, at what point do you decide that it's just not worth doing them?
Well, for us, with our vascular surgeons, we've had no deaths or any serious vascular complications. It's the vascular injuries that are the real issues we're talking about. But our vascular surgeon that does our approaches has done over 7,000 of these. This is all he does all day, so he is extremely competent. And that's sort of the person you need is someone like that, or certainly on a revision case. And that would minimize the complications there.
I think the indications for the lumbar arthroplasty are more limited versus, I think, cervical, you can address a lot more patients. But for lumbar, I think it really is more appropriate for the younger patients, for someone in their 20s or 30s who's going to have a long lifespan. And for those people, I think that maybe the benefit outweighs the risk. I found that once you get in your 50s and 60s, then patients don't do as well with the arthroplasty. They've got more facet arthropathy, and they've got more other issues going on. So it's really a limited patient who's really a candidate. I mean, most of the patients that we see are going to be the older patients. So, but for that certain patient who's in his 30s and has severe degenerative disc, the arthroplasty, I think, has a significant advantage over the fusion.
Well, Harold, I've had, in my 50s, I have 3 lumbar protists in my back. So, and I have zero pain. So I don't feel that old.
Well, no, I think that the 50s is the upper limit. And I have done them in people in their 50s. And I think that it's a special patient. I mean, not every patient in their 50s is an appropriate candidate. But, I mean, certainly in your 50s, you're probably still a candidate.
I'm glad you practice what you preach, Todd. Osdrubal, what's the role of arthroplasty in Brazil, lumbar?
Lumbar arthroplasty is less than cervical arthroplasty. The main reason is to find the right patient for the lumbar arthroplasty. So patient selection is the key for lumbar spine. And I see that it's not easy to find the right patient for the right surgery in lumbar. I see easily to define for cervical spine, but not as so easy for lumbar spine. So cervical arthroplasty is more in Brazil than lumbar spine.
Okay. Now, since we talked about revision in lumbar, let's move it to cervical, which I agree is fairly straightforward. But the questions are, would you remove an arthroplasty and replace it with another arthroplasty? If so, who is that patient? And if you convert it to a fusion, what are your results? Do you think that it really made a difference, those of you that have done so? Any takers for those questions?
Sure, I'll answer. I've experience with revising arthroplasty. And actually, to answer Nancy's question from earlier was, what happens when the arthroplasty goes on to autofuse? And what we always say is the worst result of an arthroplasty is the best result of a fusion. You end up with the same result. So, and HO, heterotopic ossification and autofusion at grade 4 HO is painless. I have had one patient get some ridiculous pain. But anyway, I'm reversing or removing arthroplasties, and not to really pick on certain devices as much, but I think some of the earlier devices, one of them is very popular now on the market. If you look at the mechanics of the disc without naming it, it's really poor. The core slides, and so the center of rotation actually moves the wrong direction. And this hyperloads the facets and keeps people in chronic pain. And so I've revised many of these discs. Now, I don't like to often revise discs to fusions. I did. But then it was the patients really, like I said earlier, want to maintain motion and mobility. So why don't we revise arthroplasty to arthroplasty? I think the hip and knee guys have done the work for us. You're not going to revise a total hip to a hip fusion. You're going to revise it to another implant. So the question then becomes, if you're going to remove an artificial disc, which is not that difficult to do in the cervical spine, which disc do you want to put in? So my preference is I go to a more stable cord device with a bigger footprint. The real key, though, is when you're explanting the height of the space that you've now created, because there will be some slight bone loss there, is which implant to use. So sometimes you'll need a 7 millimeter, and not all discs come in 7 millimeter tall. And sometimes I need an 8. Now, the only 8 out there is made by, it's the Prestige LP. And I put several of those in on removals and replacements of discs with other discs. I just did one the other day where I actually revised to, I removed Mobi-C and placed in M6, in their tallest version of M6, a 6 and a 7, I believe. And that patient's doing very well. So that you can revise arthroplasty, arthroplasty, and that's my first preference if it's possible. If there's not, significant subsidence or other issues with the bone.
My approach has been a little different. I have a number of patients that have come to me. Thankfully, these haven't been my primary patients, but they had an arthroplasty, their radicular symptoms are gone, and they had severe neck pain that was debilitating they didn't have before surgery. And I converted those all to fusions, anterior instrumented fusions. And I'm sorry to say, none of them claimed to be any better. And so it was puzzling to me, and I'm a little if the patient has chronic neck pain after the surgery, I'm not certain, you know, at least in my hands, even fusing them made a difference. What is the experience of the panel?
So Vince, I've had a couple of cases just like that. Not done by me, but I've seen patients who have had arthroplasty, have had significant continued or new neck pain. And in those two, obviously it's a small number, facet injections at the level of the arthroplasty resulted in 100% relief of their pain. And I did a simple posterior instrumented fusion at that level, and both of them have done really well. So with an N of two, I would rather revise, rather than going back in the front, removing the disc and either do a fusion or revising the arthroplasty, it's much easier to do a simple posterior instrumented fusion.
Well, let's be honest, not all neck pain is helped by surgery. So, I mean, when you look at the original films and the indication for surgery, I mean, maybe no surgery was necessary and they're having pain because they didn't really need any cervical surgery. So revising those cases is not going to help the patient anyways. Now, if the implant has failed, I mean, yeah, you have to revise the implant or it's dislodged or moved. But I've not really been a fan of revising an implant just for neck pain. I have seen cases where people have not decompressed enough and they had radiculopathy that never resolved. And that may be another case that revision is necessary. But I would be skeptical about revising an implant for neck pain.
But Harold, you're exactly right, except for the fact, as I said, they had facet injections that resulted 100% relief of their pain. Yeah. So I wouldn't do it just because they have neck pain, but I'd do it because they have facet-based pain.
Well, I think the question is, what is the source of the facet pain? Is it just facet arthropathy developing? But as I mentioned, each implant has very different biomechanics. The Mobi-C hyperloads facets, so I don't prefer that implant because I have had patients with Mobi-Cs get a lot of facet pain. So then you would think, well, if you fuse them anteriorly, even as Vince did, that those patients would have a resolution of the facet pain as the facets no longer move and they should go on to autofuse. However, you know, you also have failed osseointegration with implants. The implants themselves rarely have an issue. It's as we talked about earlier, it's usually poor placement or incomplete decompression and improper placement, as in my experience.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And so typically I would revise if I believe they have facet pain, and I block them and rhizotomize them and they're not better, I often tend to fuse or go to a slightly over-distracted implant with a fixed center rotation that offloads the facets. I give them a less chance of that working. I'm doing a guy right now who has had two revisions of Mobi-C to Mobi-C, which is the wrong implant for this particular person. And he will not have a fusion, just adamant. And so we're going to revise him to a different implant to offload the facets. And I only gave him a 50% chance of reducing his facet pain. So I keep running into these people. But then I wonder, well, do they have Cutibacterium acnes around the implant? And nobody's really cultured them. Do they have failed osseointegration of the implant? And I don't know if you're discovering that. Or are the facets themselves, they have some smoldering infection? There's a lot of questions that we don't have answers to.
I have one question, and that is, you know, I was visiting Jan Goffin in Leuven, and he was doing a lot of the Bryan disc trials, and he showed me, you know, look, this patient calcified across their disc space, so it actually was OPLL that he had never resected. How many of you are encountering patients with underlying OPLL that was never resected, and then they have this implant placed? What do you do with those patients?
So, Nancy, that's a great issue, and I'll tell you what Jan taught us is that it's really the posterior longitudinal ligament that has the tendency to calcify, especially with motion in certain patients. And so for me, and what we teach, what I teach my fellows is when you're doing a motion sparing operation, a cervical arthroplasty, we take the posterior longitudinal ligament all the way across on both sides in every patient.
Yes.
Rick, how do you handle patient with pain following a cervical arthroplasty?
Well, number one, you need to figure out where the pain's coming from.
And I'm asking Professor Hines. Since you gave us your facet strategy, I'm looking for some other strategies.
Yeah, Professor Sasso made a good point. But I think what Nancy was talking about, OPLL, I mean, I'd be reticent to resecting the ligament with OPLL, having been a complete failure every time I do it. If I don't see CSF, I haven't done my job. So I think if a patient has OPLL, they're a poor candidate for an arthroplasty to start with, because you need to resect the PLL, and I think you need to resect a large portion of the occipital joint, as you don't get that postoperative motion radiculopathy. My revision is to effusion, Vince, and for a failed arthroplasty. But what I'm seeing is because the failed arthroplasties in the community that I'm in are coming from a certain group of people, and they're destroying the endpoint. They're implanting incorrectly, and so there's not a lot to work with. The implants are loose, they're not stable, they're not put in correctly, and so it kind of destroyed my working area. I think then it's best to go to effusion. I've had good results. I totally agree with the idea. You got to test the facet joint. So some of these implants over-distract the capsule of the facet, and that causes pain all by itself, let alone just facet arthropathy. And I do inject the facet joints. If I get relief, I will go posteriorly at times. So I guess it depends on which way they present. Did they have a complete decompression of the uncinate? Did they have complete removal of the PLL? I think a lot of the community surgeons are afraid of the PLL, and they're definitely afraid of the uncinate process.
Yeah, I resect the uncinates, Rick, like you do, and not in everyone, but I certainly get a very wide decompression removing the posterior ligament and exposing. But I think it's really important to remove that uncinate in the more degenerative patient as well. But osseointegration is an issue, just as in hip and knee, and failures there. And you do see infections, the smoldering, cutie bacterium acnes, which you got to culture for 3 weeks or you won't see it. So you got to tell the lab to keep that in the dish for 3 weeks to get the answers.
Since we're talking about facets, what do people do to evaluate the facets pre-op if you're considering an arthroplasty? I know Ron Lehman has a publication talking about CT scan, but that's a lot of expense and radiation. What do the panelists do when you're considering arthroplasty in terms of facet evaluation?
If I'm concerned about arthropathic facets, I always get a CT. Now, I do that for two reasons. One, to evaluate the facets, but also to evaluate the uncinates and uncinate osteophytes. They charge $250 for a CAT scan here. There is the radiation issue. And if I'm really concerned, I do a spectra, a spec CT, with it's a fusion of the bone scan and image guided and the CT scan to get a sort of a gradient of inflammation within the facets, and they'll light up like a Christmas tree on a well done spec CT scan, and that's quite important.
Correll, what is your plan?
I agree with the CT scan. I mean, I think if there's a facet issue, it's going to be seen on the CT. Now, I don't think a 30-year-old or 40-year-old I would be getting a routine CT on, but I think if you're considering doing an arthroplasty on an older person, maybe someone older than Todd, probably is a good idea. Like, a 60-year-old or 70-year-old, that may make a difference between deciding a arthroplasty or a fusion.
Zerubbabel, how about you?
My opinion is, besides CT, I like to perform flexion and extension X-ray to understand the mobility. And if there is a loss of mobility, maybe indirectly I can have a facet arthropathy. I like to see if there is air in facet joint and the how high is the space, the disc space. If it's lower than 50% collapse, maybe it's not an option to have arthroplasty. And in those patients with OPLL, I prefer fusion. And neck pain, it's a neck pain for surgeon also. It's not only for patients. So to have a patient with neck pain, primarily or secondary surgery, my first option and second option is try to find the pain source with injections like Rixen and rehabilitation. And after I know the patient's psychology, evaluation and everything, I try to do something with surgery. And maybe I'm very propense for fusion in those patients.
Let me switch. I'm going to tell you, I had a spare case in case we were short on time, and it's a lumbar case, and it's a 45-year-old person with single just L5 S1 collapse, axial back pain, fails everything, and it's got really good favorable sacral slope. Everything looks like it's teed up for an arthroplasty, but on the MR scan, the facets look okay, but they've got fluid in them. What would you guys think about that? CT shows no arthropathy. They're the only facets in the whole spine, in the whole lumbar area, but they have fluid in them.
I might block them, just do facet blocks to see if that's a generator of their pain.
The facet block didn't change anything.
Then I would arthroplasty that patient. Terry Marnay has a huge series of those. And he really believes that when you open the disc space, offloading overstressed facets, that you'll see. He shows some excellent films of resolution of fluid as well as arthropathy improving over time. You know, we've seen others go the other way as well. But those are usually improperly placed devices. So I would move arthroplasty there.
Who? Anyone would fuse that patient?
Well, fluid on the MRI to me oftentimes indicates there's going to be instability. And I mean, I would definitely get flexion extension views and be very vigilant as far as those being done correctly and make sure there is no spondylolisthesis, because that would be a bad candidate for an arthroplasty. But assuming that there is no spondylolisthesis and it's a well-done flexion extension film, then I think the arthroplasty would be okay.
What about gouty uric acid crystals that may be focally involving those facet joints? There are rare cases of that, but.
I haven't experienced that myself.
Rick Hines, would you fuse that patient or do arthroplasty if you were going to do something?
I think it depends. I mean, look at the age, the dynamics of the patient, their expectations, the inability to really easily correct a failed arthroplasty. I would talk with the patient about what happens if the arthroplasty doesn't work, what happens if the fusion doesn't work. And I let that bring them into the discussion on issues like that, because 5-1 is particularly treacherous postoperatively, unless you have, as we talked about, these expansile opportunities. And it sounded like we got to stent the ureters and stent the iliacs in preparation for revision surgery. That already tells me we're in a place where only revision should be done in those places and not routinely. So in a community, more likely a fusion at this point. I would do the same thing that was discussed. I would inject, I might even ask my pain doctor to do a radio frequency ablation of that facet as a secondary method to determine if it was causing pain or not, or just a radiographic phenomenon. And I'm becoming, in my later part of my career, much more inclined to get preoperative CTs, because I've been let down by preoperative MRI alone in several patients where if I had just done a CT, I would have found other pain generators that would have changed my surgical decision. And then it's a risk of, well, the whole surgery failed versus the risk of a CAT scan in some of the patients.
Okay, that sounds good. Rick Sasso, fluid in the joint, everything else looks perfect for arthroplasty.
Yeah, I'm scratching my head a little bit about that, Vince. I like the question of what the facet injection, but you're telling me that was negative. So I don't know. I think, you know, I'd agree with Todd that you just sort of ignore it. Maybe that's just overloading the facets from a primary disc pathology. And then if that were the case, if all the other indications were reasonable for an arthroplasty, I think that'd be fine.
Yeah.
Who is the patient you would not do an arthroplasty on?
If they had significant facet pathology. I mean, more than just fluid, and if they had significant degenerative facet disease.
Okay. How about the capability of removing fair-sized lumbar disc herniations through the anterior approach and then arthroplasty?
I like that.
Absolutely. Remove many that way. Huge herniations, even behind the body with the right angle hook, you can pull them right out anteriorly. I've even been wondering, in the very rare cauda equina syndrome with the massive herniation, if we don't do a disservice going posteriorly because you're trying to retract already incredibly stretched nerve roots to pull out a huge fragment anteriorly. And it seems it might be better to do an anterior approach and withdraw that huge herniation immediately the way it came out is back anteriorly. And then arthroplasty or fuse that segment in general, but that's just a thought I've been having because it seems these cauda equina syndrome patients never do that well with large herniations, but you can absolutely remove huge herniated fragments and very large and even behind the body anteriorly. Done it many times and even revision herniations that way.
So how would walk me through the decision-making process of a big disc herniation, some collapse of the disc space. Am I going to do a micro disc or am I going to do, anterior decompression and arthroplasty? How do you differentiate between these two?
I would always try a microdiscectomy first. I mean, even if the person has significant back pain, the microdiscectomy, if they do have a large disc, that may help. I mean, that's a much less invasive surgery. I mean, talking about the redos and complications, et cetera. I mean, even though those are rare, those really do exist. So, I mean, I don't think there's much to lose by trying a microdiscectomy first. And if that doesn't work, you can always do an arthroplasty later. And that would be my recommendation for the patient.
Other thoughts?
Yeah, my opinion is that if the clinical presentation is sciatica, just nerve decompression. That's my idea. And if later it started with back pain, it's something new we can have, like arthroplasty or fusion, but treat just the problem, not give more problem to the patient. So if it's just sciatica, just the compression, and that's it. Same day, go home, and no problem.
How about, we'll move up to cervical then, lateral disc herniation. Could be treated through a posterior discectomy, a motion sparing operation, or anterior decompression arthroplasty. How do you guys shake through that?
I personally prefer the anterior discectomy and arthroplasty. When you do, and you have to get lateral on a posterior approach, even on a micro, you're often shaving a little bit of the medial facet joint, disrupting the capsule. So I've seen some of those later have some bridging bone and get some arthropathy in that facet, which later may not make them a good arthroplasty candidate when they have a return of neck and arm pain. So I tend to just stay away from the posterior approach as if I can. I just remember I had a conversation a long time ago with Ralph Cloward. And he said, I just don't believe in removing the patient from the disease. So when you go in the back, you're removing all this normal anatomy to get to the disease, which is an anterior disease problem. And hence he came up with the anterior operation that he advocated so well. And I always stuck in my mind that discussion. And so I think that disc disease is anterior disease.
There is, though, a tremendous body of literature that would suggest that validates posterior approach is very effective and durable in the right patient.
You're right, Vince. I had a microdiscectomy in my neck myself, posterior micro, by Tim Adamson, and did great. And 3 months later, I re-herniated, and I ended up with a fusion because it was before arthroplasty. Now I have an arthroplasty above that when I broke down on my adjacent level. So I have a cervical artificial tube. So, yeah, it worked fabulously and was painless practically.
Yeah, but I think there are many other patients who have benefited from the laminophoraminotomy, and they didn't have to have a fusion, and it was a pretty durable. It depends, you know, it has to be a very lateral and foraminal disc in order for this to be the right operation, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a great surgery, no question it works.
I would say it's like 9 to 1 in terms of the number of ACDFs versus posterior foraminotomies we do, or that I do. And I think that the posterior foraminotomy is great for certain patients, especially at C7, T1. If someone has a true radiculopathy and foraminal narrowing, it can be great, but it's just not the common patients we see who mostly has, you know, a lot of neck pain, other issues, and a central disc herniation. So I think it is a great surgery, but it's just not that common of the patient that needs it.
Rick Sasso, do you use posterior foraminotomy?
I do posterior foraminotomies, but I do way more anterior operations for cervical disc herniations. And I think that one of the fallacies, Vince, is, I mean, you can certainly decompress a nerve root posteriorly, but if you think that you're going to decrease the incidence of adjacent level problems, the studies do not support that. And you're going to have just as many adjacent level problems with a posterior non-fusion operation than you are from an ACDF. I think one of the big problems, though, is we don't have really good data on posterior foraminotomies. We have these huge retrospective studies. You're right. Lots of people have done posterior foraminotomies, but the science is not really good. And the studies, small studies that have looked at anterior versus posterior, anterior seems to be better.
Isn't one of the problems, though, now that very few senior surgeons may be doing the posterior approaches and they know how to do it, but a lot of the junior surgeons don't know how to do it?
I think there are many more people comfortable with anterior approaches, yes. How about a foraminotomy in the cervical arthroplasty patient who has some persistent radicular pain and nothing else? Rick Hines?
I think that would depend. The arthroplasty is well placed, it's not a mechanical problem with inadequate resection of the PLL and the uncinate, then a posterior foraminotomy makes perfect sense in that patient to me.
How about an anterior foraminotomy, the Joe procedure? Any comments on that?
I do that operation, but not usually as an initial. I do that if I have an arthroplasty patient and they have not had enough resection, and I actually do an anterior uncinate resection alongside the arthroplasty without explanting it. There is a role for that. I don't do that primarily.
Well, I think it's about time. Our session should end. I apologize about the slides. Anyone have anything else you want to say, a quick comment or something you think is important to impart to the audience before we move on?
I think you did a great job, Vince, under difficult circumstances.
Yeah, Vince, you did. You did a great job coming up with great questions without having a form.
I thank John Heller, who has continued to try to join us, for his effort. and each of you for donating your time and expertise to discuss these, and hopefully some of our audience will find this discussion of value. So thanks again.
Super fun, Vince.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.